All right, let's get started. Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming. My name is Julian Hyde. I'm a member of the Calcite PMC. I'm going to be talking about Apache Calcite, what it does, one of its functions, which is not as a query optimizer. So I'm the original author of Calcite, brought it into the incubator, former PMC chair, and now I'm a PMC member. For my day job, I work for Looker, also using some Calcite technology there. Looker is a BI as a service, so cloud-based analytics. I also have background in big data. I used to work for Hortonworks on Hadoop and Hive and so forth. I also have interests in things like streaming and OLAP. Okay, so to motivate this, let's look at a simple query which one would expect would be easy for an analytic database to execute. And then look at why it isn't actually so simple. So just imagine you have the 2010 U.S. Census data set, which is 100 million records, each of which represents a household. Each record is a kilobyte. So you have 100 gigabytes of data. And let's suppose you have it on a machine which has four SATA 3 disks. And the challenge is to get this query, which basically finds out the population of the U.S. by summing up the households. And the challenge is to execute that query in under 5 seconds. So it sounds like a simple query, but if you were to do a sequential scan of the data set, it takes 100 seconds just to read all that data off of disk at SATA 3 data rates. So it's just literally impossible to do if you do it in the simple-minded way. Even if you were to parallelize it, if you were to go from 4 disks to 40 disks, your throughput, I/O throughput increases. So perhaps that's going to take 10 seconds. One solution is to go and buy a lot of memory and cache the entire data set in memory. And the first time you run it, it'll be slow, and the second time you run it, it'll probably be fast, and then maybe you get a cache flush or something, and then the third time it's slow again. And of course, that approach doesn't work because as your data set gets larger, you need to buy more and more and more memory. I think the good solution to the problem is really basically to cheat, which is to pre-compute the answer and store it on disk. So if someone says, what's the population of the U.S., you say, I know it's 300 million because I computed it yesterday because I knew you were going to ask this question. And that's how analytic databases work. That's one of the main tricks that they use. Even better than that is the ability to adapt. If it has not been able to anticipate your question, but seeing that you're asking questions about the age distribution of people in Oregon, then it can maybe go and compute some, summaries of the age distribution in Oregon so that the next query you answer, it'll be able to answer from a small data set. By the way, when you materialize the data set, it doesn't actually matter whether you materialize it in memory or disk because the data set is so small that the latency is pretty much going to be the same. It's a disk seek versus a RAM access, but still, throughput isn't really a concern because the data set is so small. So the key is to do materialization, not necessarily to load it into memory. So by saving it in memory, by materializing it, you're actually saving yourself computation. It's not the effort of fetching it which you're saving. You're saving yourself the computational effort. So, to kind of boil this down to a slogan, lazy is better than smart and fast. Lazy means having already computed the answer. Smart means kind of being intelligent in terms of query optimization, or using hash joins or sort merge joins rather than nested loop joins. But there's definitely a place for that, and that's one of the main things Calcite does. And then fast is, you know, using a super efficient implementation of a database which uses LLVM and SIMD instructions. That's great too. But, you know, if you had to pick only one, I'd choose lazy. So the overview of this talk, these are kind of questions of interest, I think, to anyone building a data system or a database management system, not just for Calcite. People have been talking about self-tuning databases. How should a system tune itself? What's the information you need? What processes need to happen? How does it regulate itself? How have we done this in Calcite? You know, Calcite is it's a framework. It's not a complete product, but there's a lot of cool stuff in Calcite that if you're building a data system, you can pull in. And we talk about how you could, what are some of the tricks you can use for organized data? And second, how can we make the system self-organizing with less input from human beings? So first of all, relational algebra is the core of what Calcite does. Here we've got a SQL query and how it maps onto relational algebra. Relational algebra are the mathematical operations, which is what, you know, it's the essence of what databases do. It's an extension of predicate calculus, basically. And it's also the theoretical framework that allows query optimizers to function. In fact, you can't really build a SQL system if you don't have a query optimizer and relational algebra in the middle. If you ask the system to literally execute your queries, it will take too long. The system has to do some optimization. Relational algebra works because it has a good, solid mathematical basis, and therefore you can reason about, you can do transformations of the relational algebra to things which have the same semantics, in other words, they produce the same results, but they're more efficient. So once you have a relational algebra, you can do things like adding new implementations of, you can add a new join algorithm, you can add a new kind of index, and the application doesn't have to be rewritten because the optimizer will be able to take advantage of that. So let's just look at one query rewrite, which is, this is what Calcite does. This is how every industrial query optimizer works. You'll notice that we've got a filter. We're interested in only combining. We are only interested in employees who are under the age of 30. You notice that's happening after the join, because that's the way it's specified in SQL. But we can push the filter down through the join. Oops. I forgot I'd missed that slide. Well, there's another slide which basically shows the filter and the join swapping places. That's semantically valid. It will always produce the same results. And it's more efficient because fewer rows are going into the join, therefore the join is doing less work. Okay, so organizing data. We're talking about the same data, but there's many physical ways of representing it. And here are some of the design choices you can make. Like one is, what format do I use, CSV or JSON or Apache Arrow or something like that? Do we lay it out in column-oriented format, row-oriented format? Do we lay it out in a memory format like Apache Arrow? Where is it stored? In other words, is it in fast RAM, slow RAM, SSD? Do we actually have multiple copies of the data? So, for example, do we have a table in Tokyo and another table with the same contents in New York? Or do we have a table and then the same table just sorted on a different column? So we've now got a choice of two data sets. Or perhaps we've got lossy combinations of it, so you've got a table and you've got a summary of the same table group by department number or group by product ID. So it's a smaller table, but you can perhaps answer queries faster. Combinations of all of the above. The point of lazy is better than smart and fast. Logical optimizations are better than physical optimizations. So if you've got a summary table which has 1,000 times fewer rows, that's going to do you more benefit if you're able to use it than, say, using some smart run-length encoding, which makes your data, say, 25% smaller. Okay, so an index, a B-tree index, it kind of made relational databases possible, you know, when they were invented as a theoretical concept in about 1970, and by about 1980, the first commercial DBMSs were shipping. The B-tree index was an essential component of that because you just can't join two tables together unless you have a way to quickly go from, you know, if you have an employee with department number 20, you need to quickly find department number 20 from another table. Without an index, you don't have a chance. You have to do a full table scan for every single record of the other table. So indexes made relational databases possible. Essentially, so this is the table on the left. This is the employees table on the left. On the right-hand side, the index looks like this. When I joined the Oracle kernel development team, I was surprised to find these things that they'd been selling as indexes. Internally, the Oracle developers talk about them as tables. Inside Oracle, an index is a table. It has records. They use the same transaction concurrency control mechanisms, all the rest of it. The difference is the very last column is this row ID, which is the physical block address of the record. But you notice it has the same number of rows. It's sorted on department number, whereas the employees table is sorted on employee number. The optimizer knows about this table, and therefore when you say a query like select distinct department number, it's able to use the right-hand table. It's more efficient to evaluate the distinct department numbers from the right-hand table, you know, this index, than it is to use the left-hand one. One of the problems with this one is it's got a row ID in it, which means even when you found that, you know, Barney and Dino live in department 10, you still have to go and get those records from the employees table. So an enhancement to that, which, you know, systems like Phoenix use, quite a lot of systems use, is a covering index where all of the columns from the left-hand table exist in the right-hand table. So you don't need to use a row ID to go and get the record. You've got already got all of the data. So this is is this still an index? I'm not really sure. Because it actually really is just a copy of the table in a different sort order. Nevertheless, it's still useful. It's called a covering index because it covers every, you know, this is a pseudo SQL syntax here. Create index, cover, mno. The point is it's a column that is not needed as part of the key of the index, but it's nevertheless useful. Then lastly, a materialized view. So this has the same contents as the previous one. I've just used a different DDL syntax, create materialized view. So I think this would work in Oracle, and it would work in Calcite. What we're saying is, and this is the best representation of this, and I'll explain why. What we're doing is we're saying to the query planner, here is a table, and this table is populated using this query. So you can reference this in a query. You can say select star from emps by depno. You can reference this table in a query if you like. But you can also reference just the left-hand side, and the planner, because it knows of this relational algebra relationship between, you know, this table and the expression which created that table, it can use that to figure out when it's safe to substitute in, to take a query on the left-hand, on the employees table, and convert it into a table, a query on the sorted employees table. So this is a really powerful idea. It's not just relating to sorting. We'll see some other examples of materialized views. By the way, I think of when you've run some queries and you have a copy of your table and cache, I think of that as a materialized view because it's a copy of the data. It's in a different format. It's in memory rather than disk, but it's a copy of your table. And it's something that you would hope the system would exploit in order to answer your next query more quickly. Spatial queries. I did a talk on spatial queries earlier today. There's only going to be a couple of slides about spatial, but it's kind of interesting to see how this stuff overlaps. So a spatial query is, I'm in this yellow dot, and I'm interested in all restaurants that are within 1.5 kilometers of where I am. It's actually really difficult to use a regular relational database to execute this, because I might decide to index by X, Y, which means my index will basically be a set of vertical stripes, a raster scan through the data, which means if my data is in disk, my disk head will have to go onto the disk, lift off, go onto the disk, lift off, probably several times. It'll have to do lots of different seeks because the data, even for that small region, that data is spread over multiple areas of the disk. So in technical terms, we've lost locality. The stuff which is local in two dimensions is no longer local when we convert it into a one-dimensional index. So that's a problem. And we don't, in order to execute this, we don't want to evaluate the ST distance function for every single restaurant. We would like to narrow it down to a set of candidates. So the trick is to use this, a space-filling curve, or let's say one trick, is to use a space-filling curve where you assign every point, every XY point, you assign every XY point an integer, which is its distance along this space-filling curve. So as you can see there's, on the right-hand side, we've got 8 times 8, 64 points. The space-filling curve has a length of 64, and therefore any given point has a unique number, you know, like number 34, a unique number, which is its distance along the curve. Now, this space-filling curve has pretty good locality, because if you think of where that yellow spot was, that is in a particular region of that space-filling curve. Actually, there's one other segment of the space-filling curve a bit later on that hits it. But in general, it's going to be one or two, or perhaps, in worst case, about three areas of the space-filling curve. In other words, that disk head can scan and then stop and then scan, and then it's probably found everything that could possibly be in the region. So we change, look at this query over here. We change this query as distance between point and point is less than 1.5. We've added an extra where clause to this. We've said this Hilbert index is between 35 and 42 or between or equal to 46. So that's because this Hilbert function has given us some false positives. It's given us some points which are actually slightly further away than 1.5 kilometers. But there's no false negative, so they're all in there. And this table here, we've added a column H to this table, and we've sorted the table on H. So if we use a sorted table database, such as HBase, we can just do a scan of that table to find the restaurants that we're interested in. So how does the optimizer figure out to put this in here? Well, it's because we told it about the column. So when we create this table, we say column H double generated always as ST Hilbert. We're saying this column is generated by the system whenever you insert a record as the Hilbert function of X and Y. And we've said, please sort the table on H. That is enough information for the optimizer to be able to figure out to do that automatic rewrite on the query. So the user hasn't had to use column H in their query. The optimizer basically inserts it automatically. Another case where materialization is useful, if you're dealing with a streaming system and you're doing streaming SQL using Apache Beam or Apache Flink or something like that, you're interested not only in doing streaming queries, so every time someone places an order which is larger than 1,000 units, tell me about it. That's what the streaming query does. But I'm also interested in historic queries. So tell me everything, tell me how many orders there have been over the last hour, which were larger than 1,000 units. That's actually not a streaming query. It's a regular tabular query. It's looking in historic data. But I don't want the system to have to go back and recompute it. I'd like the system to just know. So you can see to support a historic query, actually, I need something like a materialized view. I need the system to precompute the answer and then to be able to ask it to tell me. So the reason that SQL is a good language for streaming is because it actually allows me to create hybrid queries that tell me, for example, show me all the orders that have occurred, or every time there's an order which is greater than the average price of that product over the last year, tell me about it. So we're basically doing a self-join between the order stream and the history of the order stream. Now, I'm not going to go into how exactly that would be implemented, but you can see you need some kind of materialized view which represents this you know, average order price per product, and the system needs to use that to filter the stream. So in summary, materialized views are really useful because they give the optimizer, they're just tables in terms of how they're stored, but the optimizer knows the purpose of that table and therefore it can automatically insert them into queries to make the queries faster. Okay, but who designs these materializations? So the learning process would be, well, the goals of the learning process are improving response time, throughput, in other words, can the system support 50 concurrent queries, and also improve storage costs. We don't want to burn a huge amount of disk or a huge amount of memory to do what the system is designed to do. We also want it to be predictable. You know, we don't want the query to take a millisecond one day and 100 seconds the next day. And we also want human intervention because, you know, just like self-driving cars, self-driving databases are not a reality, and we need humans to be able to tune them. How do systems learn? Well, today it's mainly database administrators who tune them by creating indexes and so forth. But we want them to be able to adapt either, you know, based on what happened the last month or what's been happening over the last 2 minutes. You know, what queries have people been executing that they've never executed before? Some kind of adaptations are pretty useful, pretty obvious, really. A cache, right? You've just executed a query on some data. It's now in memory. The thing runs faster. That's an adaptation. It's not a very smart one, but it's an incredibly useful one. Cached query results, not just caching the raw data, but actually caching what came out of the join and the aggregate and the order by clause. And then perhaps another way to adapt is noting that this table is very frequently joined to on this particular column, so maybe we should actually sort it on that column, rather than having it in an unsorted order. This is kind of a target architecture that I think analytic systems, OLAP systems, should be heading for, which is the raw data is on disk because probably you have more data than you have available memory. But if someone has just executed a query, then it has summarized that data and kept it in memory. So when someone executes the next query of the day, you know, select X, select X and sum of N group by X, perhaps these are horizontal time slices. Some of the time slices of the data have already been cached into memory and been computed. So perhaps we've already computed the results of this query for 2014 data, but 2015 data is still on disk. If the system can somehow recognize that it only needs to go to the disk for 2015, then we've saved ourselves a lot of effort. And it's now adapted because it's brought 2015 into memory, and now the next time we've got basically got the entire data set in memory. Actually, not the data set, but the data set grouped by X. So this data in memory is still significantly smaller than the data on disk, but it's actually more useful because the computation that's necessary for this particular analytic has already been mostly done. Am I making sense? Okay. So, the process of designing materialized views is a complicated one. I mean, these happen in enterprise. Any enterprise with a data warehouse has been doing this process manually. So these things need to be done. The question is how much of this can happen automatically. So first of all, we need to decide which materializations to create. Second, we need to populate them. So create index or create materialized view. Then they need to be maintained. So if the data is modified every hour, if there's a new data load every hour or every second, we need to maintain those so that they reflect reality. The optimizer or a human, some part of the system needs to rewrite queries to use these things. And then as query patterns change and data access patterns change, we need to adapt them to whatever's changing. Then lastly, we'd hope to be able to express not just core SQL, but also stuff like spatial queries, streaming queries, graph database queries, and exploit these, solve complex data problems with these things. I'm going to talk about summary tables here, because OLAP is familiar to everyone. But the same basic process could be used for other kinds of indexes as well. So I'm going to assume for now that the data is organized into a star schema, which is a central fact table, which has a lot of rows, and then surrounding dimension tables that have fewer rows. An example of this is the sales fact table. And each sale is made by a customer and relates to a product. So so in order to get all the information one would use to do analytics, we need to basically join sales and time and customers and product together. So initially, we're just assuming that the users have, I mean, this is kind of a, system like Kylin, you define a cube. So it's a pretty common thing in any OLAP system is you basically tell, and in Looker, you define and explore. So this is kind of defining your business model and the joins that you're going to take. So in Calcite, we assume you've created this thing called a lattice, which describes those relationships. Still, we have to decide within that lattice which summary tables are we going to create. So in this particular case, this is a summary table which is by year and state and zip code. We might have another summary table which is by quarter and state, for example. So many different possible layers of aggregation. And it turns out this space of summary tables is huge. If you've got 10 attributes, then there's 2 to the 10 possible summary tables. Because you might, if you've got A, B, C, D, E, you could say group by A, group by A, B, group by A, B, C. There's 2 to the 10 combinations of those. And a typical data warehouse has possibly 100 attributes, so the search space is phenomenal. To give you a feel of this, let's imagine we've got a database which has 1 million rows. So the unaggregated data at the bottom is 1 million rows of data. If we group by nothing, we end up with 1 row, which is the grand total. If we were to say group by state, then we end up with 50 rows. If we group by zip code, we've got 43,000 rows because there's 43,000 zip codes in the US. If we group by zip code and state, we end up with slightly more than 43,000 zip codes because 1 or 2 zip codes actually cross state boundaries. So each of these is a possible summary table that we could create. we need an algorithm which will choose which ones to create. So we're basically heading for this, right? The orange ones are the ones that we've decided to create. And when you've created one, if I've decided to choose, zip code, state, and gender, and by the way, this is traditional binary gender for just simplicity, we can roll up from this to this because we can roll up. We can combine records. If we're grouping by fewer columns, then we can just summarize other records into a large number of records into smaller records. So that's why we don't need to create all of them. So any of these black ovals, which is above an orange oval, we can get with a fairly small amount of effort, we can compute it. So we have this algorithm. There's an implementation of this in Calcite. It's based on a paper from the late 1990s that made it look fairly straightforward. They just said, use a greedy algorithm, choose the first summary table, which gives you the most incremental benefit. In other words, has the highest benefit, which the benefit is the amount of effort that it will save you over the space of possible queries, and the cost is basically the amount of disk space that it uses. So it sounds a very simple algorithm. And it's a greedy algorithm, which means it's computing the approximate best, but it's a fairly close approximation. The problem is that it assumes that you already know how large all of those summary tables are. And to compute the size of one of these summary tables, you actually have to do a select count distinct. In fact, you have to do 2 to the 100 select count distinct queries to figure out all of the stats. So that's going to take this algorithm, if it's going to run off perfect statistics, is going to take a ridiculously large amount of time to run, because getting the stats requires you to query the data for an awful lot of times. So in order to make this algorithm run faster, I realized we needed a data profiler. You can think of this as like analyze table on steroids. What we need, kind of stating it somewhat formally, we need to calculate count distinct A, B, C for every combination of attributes. But we're okay. We don't mind if we have an approximation to that. And in fact, as you will see later, not computing at all if we can deduce them from other things that we've already calculated. So first attempt was to compute every single combination, which is, we were assuming 30 attributes here, so 2 to the power of 30 select count distinct queries. Next approximation is let's use sketches. Hyperloglog is a very efficient algorithm to compute approximate count distinct. It takes about 10K of memory to compute an approximation to count distinct that's about 99% accurate. So using sketches, we can compute, if we have a reasonable amount of memory, we can compute about 10,000 sketches at a time. So we do a full table scan and we compute select count distinct for 10,000 combinations of attributes. That gets us a pretty long way, right? We can compute probably 1 or 2 or possibly 3 attribute combinations. But still, it's going to still take us an awful lot of full table scans to compute the full 2 to the power of 30 combinations. So step 3, we had to kind of introduce some information theory. Let me just go into sketches a little bit more. Who's heard of Hyperloglog? Only one. Okay, well. So it's worth explaining it to the room. Okay. So Hyperloglog, this chart over here shows the relative error of the Hyperloglog algorithm. A sketch is a data structure that you populate that... you can then read a result from. So it's like an aggregate function, but it's computing. It's collecting some data from which you can read an approximate answer to the data set, and using a lot less memory than actually storing all of the data. And as you can see, I mean the error rate is basically in the between 1% and 2%, with ranging up from 10 values all the way to a million values. So it's a pretty astonishing algorithm, and sketches are one of the most important innovations that's happened in the database field, in the last 20 years. So with 16 megabytes of memory, we can compute 10,000 sketches at the same time, which basically gets us down to 10 to the 5 passes of our data. So now let's use some information theory. And let's suppose we're combining the gender column and the state column. We already know there are two distinct genders in this data set. We already know there are 50 distinct states. Let's estimate, using Bayesian probability, how many combinations of gender and state there are. Well, we predict there are 100, and surprise, surprise, there are 100. Okay, so the surprise is zero, which means we don't even bother to store that result in our model. The combination of month and zip code also has a very low surprise. The combination of state and zip code has a much higher surprise. You'd think with 50 states and 43,000 zip codes, you'd think there would be 800,000 combinations. Actually, there's 43,400 combinations. Those variables are correlated. It's not a functional dependency, because there are some zip codes that cross state boundaries, but there's a high degree of correlation. Therefore, that actual cardinality is surprising. It's surprising enough that we, A, want to record it in our model, and secondly, we're going to want to explore some more combinations of attributes related to that to see if there's more surprise coming. But when we encounter if you think of this as a huge search tree that we're looking through, whenever we discover that something is unsurprising, we can basically prune away that part of the search tree and save the effort. So we're no longer having to go and visit all of those 2 to the 30 possible combinations of attributes. So this is the basic algorithm. I won't go through the code, but the idea is basically to start off with the low cardinality combinations of attributes like one column or two columns, once we've computed the cardinality of these, now we figure out where the surprising combinations, if we were to add one extra attribute, are going to be. If we've already got a combination of two attributes and they have 999,000 distinct values, the cardinality of the result cannot be more than a million, because we only have a million rows in the table. Therefore, we would not bother to compute the successor to that, because we know that it can't be very surprising. So this thing actually converges surprisingly fast. So this is running the algorithm. This first jump here is the first pass that we've made. And then these points are the surprisingness of all of the... So yeah, this first batch in the top left corner have surprise 1, because we're starting with no information whatsoever. And then as the algorithm progresses, we set this surprise threshold. So actually, we actually want things, as we get kind of more jaded and cynical, we want things to be more and more surprising, and because we're not going to add them to our model unless they're very surprising. Because we're prepared to accept a greater error rate as if we have higher cardinality combinations of attributes. So, yeah, the algorithm has kind of slayed the dragon, and we've defeated this combinatorial search space. It produces a model, what the machine learning folks would call a model, which is a blob of data from which we can answer any question. You know, any of those 2 to the 30 combinations of attributes, we can give a pretty reasonable estimate of the cardinality. And there's this nice byproduct, which is if it discovers things like state and zip code, it's discovered attributes that have a strong correlation. In other words, we can use this to detect hidden keys in our data, in our databases. If X is functionally dependent on Y, that means Y is a key. And that is a strong indication that we've actually, this table was produced by joining two tables together which had a functional dependency. Like if we notice every time we sell product ID 1000, the color is green, well, you've discovered that the color of the product is functionally dependent on the product ID. Of course, a human would know that, but we can use this algorithm to discover that kind of thing. Any questions? Great. Yes? Is it related to?
Formal quantum analysis. You have object features and then you compute how you navigate partial order.
It may be. So it sounds like if you're talking about features, I guess you're talking about machine learning and so forth. My background in machine learning is pretty weak, but this is clearly computational statistics, and so I wouldn't be surprised if the machine learning community has come up with something like this. I couldn't find anything based on my knowledge of machine learning, but if something similar to this exists, I would definitely like to know about it. The next question is, we assumed at the start that a human, told the system about the structure of the star schema. They've said, we've got the sales table, it's always joined to the product table and the customers table and so forth. Can we skip that step? Can we basically have a database where the user doesn't tell us anything about the structure of the schema, we just see the queries that are coming in and the system deduces what relationships are commonly accessed or what combinations of tables are used together. So in other words, we want to generate that create lattice statement based on the query load that we see. So we came up with this algorithm where it basically deduces, it kind of watches for the query load and it looks for join patterns in queries. So let's suppose the first query is a sales table joined to customers table. The next query is sales table joined to product table joined to the product class table. After that, we've basically grown this lattice like growing a snowflake or something that has combined those two queries together. So that's in a prototype stage in Calcite. We have some work to do to avoid false positives, like the, you know, all the outlier queries that join tables together that are not generally used. But it does seem to be, you know, having some benefit. Okay. So, and to summarize what we've talked about, we would like systems which are able to learn and adapt, and allow manual tuning, but also adapt to query load, and also use smart algorithms that basically look at query history and use that to optimize the organization of the system. So we take that combination of query history, looking at the shape of the data, the cardinalities of various keys. We use lattices initially produced by humans, perhaps later induced by the query load, and then produce summary tables, which are a form of materialized views. Materialized views are a really powerful concept that basically pervade an awful lot of things that databases do. Even if they don't call them materialized views, they're cleverly using copies of data to make things faster. And relational algebra is kind of the language, underlying language, that makes all this stuff possible. So that's all I have. Thank you. Uh, Yeah, is Hive used commercially? Yeah, let's skip over this. So Calcite is used in all of these things, and others as well. Most of those are open source, but it's also used in commercial systems that we can't put on this slide. Plus, as anyone open source knows, you only find out who's using you when they encounter a bug. So, yes. Yeah, updating materialized views, especially summary tables, is not straightforward because it can generate. If you try and do it too often, you can generate write multiplication. You have 100 transactions, and now you need to write, or 100 records are updated. You need to write 100 blocks to the summary table. So, I think you have to use. In a real system, you have to use a clever materialized view update strategy where you perhaps store the updates in a message queue or something like that and then apply them, update the materialized views at a sensible time frequency. And then you have to use something like, maybe you know that your materialized view was updated 2 hours ago, and so you can basically take the answer from the materialized view but then also combine in the last 2 hours of data, which is not yet being rolled into the materialized view. I think you have to use some kind of hybrid. Yeah, the right combination depends on the update frequency. If you get a new set of data every day, then perhaps you index it, you put it into the materialized view when you receive it. But if you're receiving new data every millisecond, if it's trickling in from Kafka, then you shouldn't be maintaining your materialized view all the time. But you can still have this hybrid approach where you're giving the correct answers to the user and you're using the materialized view for 99.9% of your data and then reading the deltas for the stuff that hasn't been written in yet. I mean, if you compare, if you look at how Hive does Hive Acid does updates, It's very, or indeed how a system like Vertica does, loads of data into its column store. You see this similar pattern where you've basically got old data in one format and then newer data in a different format. No, I'm not saying that. I think you can't have a good database without a query optimizer. Of course, I mean, just like every talk at this conference, the project I work on is the center of the universe.
that's just the impression.
Okay, well, I'm good. Good. I'm glad you got that impression. Yep. Any more? Yeah, yeah. Can you answer your question?
Then if you had the tables and the summaries for people, the queries you got from the runtime system.
Yeah.
And how you kind of follow doing the materialized views. The one before this. Yeah. So does the ordering of tables matter? Like, so for example, if you had customers join to sales rather than sales to joins,
No, if it's sales on the left and customers on the right, it doesn't. But the keys that you use to join them together, I mean, it's possible that sales could join to customers via two different foreign keys. That's definitely possible. We regard that as a different use of the customers table.
So it's kind of an
It's a graph, right? It's a subgraph. Yes.
You're not using for like information to figure out which should drive the joint. Because if you've got the information from hyperlog log, which is your cardinality,
yeah. We do use the cardinality of the table to figure out what is the central fact table. In other words, which are many to one relationships. Okay. It is possible to have a large table joining to a smaller table where it's actually a one to many relationship rather than many to one relationship, but that's unlikely. Yeah. By the way, I will. If you want a copy of these slides, I will tweet them out on the Apache Cal site Twitter account. So look there in a little while. Thank you, everybody.